Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 205 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. First of all, let me wish you all the best for the new year, 2019. Apologies for the repeat shows the last 2 weeks. Tuesday was both Christmas Day and New Year's Day, where listeners' ship is low, so it didn't seem appropriate to load new shows. And talking of listeners, we had more than 28,000 downloads in 2018. Woo! Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm or subscribe as a podcast. You can listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990. If you'd like to sponsor this show, you can make a one-time donation via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for them. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. Well, we have a little bit of extra time this month, so let's get caught up on some feedback. Stanian on Twitter wrote, "Thank you so much for the beautiful work. How about an interview with cancer advisor Ralph Moss? He's very expert in alternative therapies offered around the world. I'll put him back on my list. I did try to contact him once before, but did not get a response. But I did read his book from the 1990s, The Cancer Industry, which is a classic." Zoe, also on Twitter, wrote, "Very good interview. Thank you for giving Megan Murphy a voice. Thank you also for reading Florence Ashley's condescending and emotive emails. He's a typical TRA, which I believe stands for transgender rights activist, and cannot answer clear and respectful questions." On the Dick Ablin interview regarding PSA testing and prostate cancer, Jane on Facebook wrote, "It was super informative. Thanks. Donald, I will buy his book. It was one of your best shows." But Fakeologist wasn't so happy. He wrote, "The audio quality of your shows is awful. Can you possibly buy a mic? I'll be glad to help fix your audio. The PSA interview audio quality was the worst I've ever heard, yet was possibly your most important interview ever. Your website is Podbeans, and that too is awful. Host your own to avoid censorship. I see no links to your PayPal, so I'll take a chance and send you the money to this email." Well, I do have a really good mic. The audio problems were not my mic. They were on Dick's end, and I should have stopped the interview and made sure that we had a good connection before continuing, but as he said, it was very important. So I do strive to learn more about getting good audio, and hopefully we won't have repeats of the audio quality of that one. James McComiskey, who was a previous guest on the show, wrote, "I'm listening to your interviews and I'm enjoying them." There was a Rolling Stone article recently, "Who Will Fix Facebook?" subtitled, "In its effort to clamp down on fake news, Russian trolls and Nazis, the social media giant has also started banning innocent people, proving again it can't be trusted to regulate itself. First they came for Alex Jones, Nazis and Russian trolls, then they came for anyone else with an opinion." I actually have direct experience with this. The discussion group for Rethinking AIDS has been banned by Facebook with a very Kafkaesque situation. We're given a button that we can click, and if we click the button, they will do a review of the changes we've made to the site, and if they don't like it, they will delete the site permanently. There is no indication of exactly what they thought was wrong with the Facebook group for the discussions of Rethinking AIDS. Ironically, the same group has another dozen sites in different countries like Indonesia and Malaysia and France and Holland, and none of those have been blocked. So it seems to be kind of sporadic, but there's no communication. Even writing to Facebook has not elicited a response. Writing a paper letter as well as through their help system. I posted this on the, ironically, on the Infectious Myth Facebook page. Mindy responded, "I wonder if people who shop using eBay, Google, Amazon, Washington Post, and other conglomerates that are destroying our society know they are supporting their own educational and critical thinking demise. Fascist book is just part of the equation. Michael wrote, I've been put in Facebook jail more than 6 times. Stephen wrote, in 2014, he launched Reverb, a site that shared news from a pro-democratic stance, but also, Reader says, took great care to be correct and factual. This was in the Rolling Stone article. Stephen comments, this is not the easiest task to be correct and factual while being positive towards a party led by Hillary, Obama, Holder, Schultz, etc. I responded, in my opinion, the U.S. two-party system results in both parties becoming corrupt and results in tribalistic comments like Stephen's. Dogmatic Democrats and Republicans are alike in that they think everything their party does is wonderful and everything the other does is corrupt, and they can't see that both parties are corrupt. They cling to the two-party system and mock and criticize third parties such as the Libertarian and Green parties, who aren't successful because the system doesn't allow it. Back to Megan Murphy. Bridget on Facebook wrote, it was a great interview. It's how I learned about your site. Brian, via email, I'm new to your material, but I'm really enjoying the discussion. Thank you. Do you have any episodes where you discuss herpes and STDs? Not that I have any. I'm just interested in all things viral now that you've planted the seeds. I responded thanking Brian for his positive words and said that I'd love to do something on herpes and STDs, but I'd need to find the appropriate expert because that's one area I haven't really studied. I did write an article on syphilis some time ago, and I realized that syphilis has many of the same problems as HIV and AIDS, including reliance on antibody tests, and you have people with positive tests and no symptoms, and people with symptoms of syphilis but negative tests. This article was stimulated by a phone call from an elderly nurse who sent me some 1960s-era documents from Ontario indicating that the diagnosis and treatment were based on science that was seriously flawed. But if I can find someone to interview on this subject, please let me know. And dear listener, if you know of somebody who's critiqued the herpes viral model or other STD models, please contact me. Well, let's get to the interview now. Curtis Hagen earned his PhD in philosophy from the University of Hawaii in 2002. He received a scholarship and then a postdoctoral fellowship supporting a total of 4 years of study and research in Japan. He then taught philosophy for 11 years at SUNY Plattsburgh, becoming associate professor and chair of the philosophy department. He's now an independent scholar and author. Recent publications include Philosophers of the Warring States, a sourcebook in Chinese philosophy, and Conspiracy Theory, a Philosophical Defense, a new pamphlet that's available for a dollar or two, depending on your currency, on Amazon. He was last on the show in April 2014, it's more than 4 years ago, talking about conspiracy theories, and we're going to update that conversation now. Welcome to the show, Curtis.
Thank you, David. Glad to be here.
So tell me how you got into studying conspiracy theories in the first place. What made you interested about it?
Well, I have to admit it was the 9/11 conspiracy theory, and it was back in 2006 when I started to hear some stuff about that and got interested in that, and then noticed some academic research on the topic. In fact, philosophers, a book came out in 2006, the philosophy, that's what it's called, Conspiracy Theories, the Philosophical Debate. And so so that I saw some fellow philosophers involved in this topic, and that's and then after that, there was an article by Cass Sunstein that came out, which my first two articles responded to. And so that's kind of...
Right. I wanted to ask you about that particular episode a little bit later. So you were talking to me before we got on this call about a bunch of French social scientists who wrote a piece in Le Monde, a big French newspaper, and a group of philosophers that included yourself and some social scientists responded, and then there was a response to that, and then that ended up in a book. So can you talk about that back and forth conversation that happened?
Sure. Well, first let me give a little background in terms of the difference between the disciplines. So in philosophy, there had been a debate about whether you could just dismiss conspiracy theories for general reasons or whether you had to take each of them seriously in their particulars and judge them individually on their merits. Okay, and so basically the latter has sort of carried the day in the philosophical literature. But over in the social science literature, especially in psychology, conspiracy theorists continued to be sort of pathologized and studied under the rubric of anomalistic psychology.
So what's wrong with these people? Can
Right,
we figure out what's
exactly.
wrong with them? Yeah.
Right, so you assume that there's something wrong and then you study them. And so because there had already sort of been a debate about whether or not conspiracy theories can be assumed to be wrong in the philosophical literature, and the consensus ended up being no, you kind of have to treat them on their own merits. There became kind of this, a different set of assumptions in those two different disciplines. And so this kind of came to head in a conference in 2015 in Miami, where philosophers and social scientists got together and they talked about their research and whatnot. And then the next year, a group of social scientists wrote this piece for the Le Monde, where it was titled "Let's Fight Conspiracy Theories Effectively." And the context of that was the French government was either implementing or was planning on implementing some program to try to sort of educate people to stop the spread of conspiracy theories. And these scholars sort of objected to that proposal, not because they disagreed with the idea, but because they thought that, wait, before you go off and do that, shouldn't you fund some more research to study how we can do this most effectively? Otherwise, it might backfire. So that was their angle. Of course, they're the ones who are going to want to do this to do the research, right? So they're sort of asking for funding for themselves.
Which is a common denominator in scientific discussions, I find, is that it's not usually, well, that was simple, we've solved a problem, we're done. It's usually, we need to study this more. We need more funding. The government is not doing the right thing because they're not paying enough money to my group to study
Right.
whatever it is.
Right, right, right,
That's a
right.
common denominator.
So that's what it was. And so several philosophers and some social scientists as well wrote a little piece that was published online in something called the Social Epistemology Review and Reply Collective. It's just freely available online. And we included an English language translation of the Le Monde piece. And we objected to that project. And then eventually they wrote a rather sprawling response to our response. And then many of us individually responded to that, and also on the same Social Epistemology Review and Reply Collective website. So there was this kind of debate that was going on there. And ultimately, one of us, M. Dentith, he collected a bunch of the contributions, and we were invited to expand them, and they formed part of the basis for his new book, Taking Conspiracy Theories Seriously.
I think people intuitively know that when you call something a conspiracy theory, it's not a compliment, and it's used by people often who want to be sophisticated. So, scholars, government officials, TV news personalities will often casually refer to something that's just a conspiracy theory. So, what really is a conspiracy theory?
Well, so I'm working on a book, and the first chapter is What is a Conspiracy Theory?
Okay, so
And
hopefully you've written that chapter.
right, I have, but it's
Okay.
a whole chapter, right? It's
Yes.
not one or two sentences. So, because there's different takes on that. So the first take, or one take, would be, well, a conspiracy theory is just a theory about a conspiracy. But of course, as you point out, that's not how it's used, right? And so I kind of think that there is some merit in defining a word and according to how it's actually used. But there's another definition. Some people want to define a conspiracy theory as an unwarranted theory about conspiracies or something, or an unreal that posits an unreal conspiracy. And so a pejorative definition that sort of assumes that it's false.
Right.
I think that's not any good either, right? Because, well, people on all sides of the debate have essentially all agreed that some conspiracy theories have turned out to be true, because they'll accept Watergate and Iran-Contra.
Well, legally, what is a conspiracy, especially in the United States?
Well, sure, right. And so, but again, when we say a conspiracy theory, we don't just mean a theory about a conspiracy.
Right. So, no, I understand. But I mean, as you say, words have meaning. So if you're a lawyer, obviously we're not specifically talking about that, but it sort of grounds the term in something pretty right. well-defined. So if you and I are talking about, you know, me shipping drugs to you across the border, is that a conspiracy, according to the people monitoring our calls?
Yeah, legally speaking, it would be. I would think, yeah.
So just two or more people getting together
sure.
to do something
illegal
or dubious
or yeah. something mm-hmm. like that. Yeah, not a birthday party, probably.
Right. It doesn't have to be anything particularly dramatic. Like, we don't have to be planning to blow up buildings. We could just be planning to ship an illegal quantity of illegal drugs across the border. And just the two of us. Doesn't have to be 16 people.
Right. In terms of the word conspiracy, right.
Yeah.
But as soon as we say conspiracy theory,
okay,
if we
it's
mean
slightly
something
different.
More than just a theory about a conspiracy, but a theory about a certain kind of conspiracy. So I, following some other philosophers, I think it's helpful to throw in things like a theory about a conspiracy that is in contrast to some official account.
Mm.
Okay. And then people can argue, well, are there reasons to think that the official account is usually right? Well, it may be usually right, but it's not always right. So we can't just dismiss something because it's in opposition to an official account.
Has our government ever lied to us? rhetorical question.
So in addition to that, like if we were to say, you know, Saddam is out, he's hiding the weapons or whatever, that's not a conspiracy theory. Well, partly because it's our official account is he's doing that, but also because usually if we blame, you know, somebody else, especially like in a dictatorship or something like that, we wouldn't call that a conspiracy theory. So usually it's if we attribute some kind of morally dubious activity to some Western elites or leaders.
Well, that's an important part of it, right? It has to be an elite. I think in the common usage of conspiracy theory, right? Like, I mean, the way I understand it is that powerful people are saying, you know, you're imagining that there's a bunch of powerful people who are, you know, poisoning vaccines. That's your imagination. They have to be powerful people, because if they weren't powerful, they couldn't do it. And if there wasn't a conspiracy, if they didn't all agree to keep quiet about it, then it would be public and, you know, nobody would take this vaccine, right? To me, that's kind of the implication. It has to be powerful people. There has to be an agreement amongst them that they're going to keep this whole thing quiet. And the implication is you just imagined it because you don't want to believe the truth.
Right, right. And, you know, one thing I like to point out is that people often frame this as an all or nothing kind of a situation. Either there's a conspiracy where everybody's in on the conspiracy, or at least, you know, there's this large group that are in on it, or there's no conspiracy. But it doesn't have to be like that at all. I mean, there can be some collusion here and there, and there can be a lot of people just following orders, and there can be some incompetence that goes in, and there can be a whole lot of you know, different things going on at the same time. It can be all very confusing, and it can be all mostly not conspiratorial, and yet there might still be some important element that is.
Well, if in the early 2000s, I don't remember exactly when the discussion about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq was happening, but if I was to have said at that time, I don't believe that Saddam has weapons of mass destruction, I probably would have been, that probably would have been received negatively by a lot of important people, but would they have accused me of it being a conspiracy theory?
As soon as you even hinted that the authorities were lying when they suggested that we found them or that we know where they are, that kind of a thing, then at that point, I think it would have been called a conspiracy theory.
Oh, okay, because the assumption is that if there are no weapons of mass destruction, we have many people in the U.S. government and other governments saying there are. So right. Therefore, the only way that they could be lying is if there was a conspiracy. But, I mean, couldn't there be a case where there is, like, one person who, like, fakes something and a lot of people just want to believe it? So yeah, they're not right. Very skeptical?
Sure. I mean, hypothetically. But my suggestion was just a sort of a modification of that. I mean, usually it's not going to be just one person. But there might be a minor conspiracy. Maybe if just a few people fake the you know, yellow cake thing or whatever.
Right.
And like you say, everyone else bought in because they wanted to buy in. And so it's not like there was this whole big, huge conspiracy. But it's not that there wasn't any conspiracy at all either.
I think a really important factor that's not really considered by people who like to talk about conspiracy theories is the power of hierarchy. I mean, I think a military hierarchy is the best example. I mean, let's say that you're, you know, a guy like Chelsea Manning and, you know, you're in Iraq in some horrible, you know, situation, and you suddenly decide that the war is wrong. You pretty much know that if you come out with that publicly amongst your fellow soldiers, there's going to be a huge negative reaction. There's going to be negative consequences for you. So there's this huge pressure to shut it up. Or imagine a priest who wakes up one day and says, I don't believe God exists, but I have a nice job. I get paid. I don't know what I'd do if I wasn't a priest. So I'm just going to shut my mouth, because if I start telling my other priests, big trouble's going to happen.
Right.
Even if some of them don't believe in God, they're all going to... They know their place in the hierarchy.
Right. There's this uneven, as I mentioned before, sort of this uneven consequences depending on which way you go on your belief.
And in your experience as an academic, I mean, academics are theoretically these sort of individuals who have tenure, but often don't, but let's say they have tenure. They're completely an island intellectually, right? Nobody can touch them. They can't lose their job unless they, you know, sleep with the university president's wife or something like that, you know, some crime outside a non-academic failing. But what's the reality if you're an academic who has an opinion that goes against the grain?
Well, academics are very concerned about their reputation with other academics. And so they don't have to lose their job to lose their credibility, which is very important to them. So if a theory is just regarded as, you know, just completely discredited,
right?
Even if it's not, but as long as the consensus is that it is, mm-hmm. then, you know, you don't look good espousing it. So there is that dynamic to be concerned about. And the fact that you have tenure doesn't really change that.
So what other benefits does an academic get that they could lose if they're considered to be on the wrong side of the consensus?
Well, you can look at like Peter Duesberg's case,
right.
for example.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, your funding dries up, but I think those are pretty extreme. Usually it's just a matter of accolades or being respected and cited and all those subtle things that go on, and people, you know, collaborating with you if you're in one of those fields where people need to collaborate, those kinds of things.
Well, there was a professor, and I can't remember his name, a black professor who was also a CNN commentator, who made some comments against the Israeli state, and he used a phrase that has been used by terrorists as well, and he claimed a lot of people used it, but he was immediately kicked off CNN, but also for a while was threatened with losing his university job, which seemed, you know, his tenure wasn't going to protect him from what the university was calling hate speech or something like that.
Right. And I don't know much about that case.
Yeah.
I didn't know about the academic part of it. But yeah, I mean, that kind of thing. I mean, there's James Tracy from a university here in Florida, who lost his job a year or two ago because of his, well, arguably it was because of his take on the Sandy Hook shootings. He had a blog about that. And I don't know, there may be a real conversation to be had about if there are boundaries, but yeah, there are times where people have faced at least the threat of being fired,
and I think the threat often reins people in.
Sure.
Like if you're in any kind of a vulnerable financial situation, which most people are, they've got a mortgage. Maybe they're the only income earner in the family, and they've got children, other responsibilities. If you lose your job, you could be in serious trouble, right? You might lose your house. Certainly, your feeling of self-worth is going to take a hit if you can't look after the people you're supposed to be looking after. So it's tempting to just back off what you were going to say.
Yeah, and I think usually, probably, it's a psychological thing that happens. It's probably, you know, I don't know how, you know, percentage-wise, but I think it's probably very common. It's not that you consciously decide, I'm going to back off. It's that you subconsciously decide to back off, right? Because of the biases that are set up, because of the dynamics.
Yes, there are times in myself where I've heard something and I sort of have this feeling like, that doesn't really make sense to me. And then the fact that everybody else is accepting it kind of lulls me into a sense of, well, I guess it's got to be true. And then later, somebody will come out with a really good criticism and I'll go, you know, I should have followed my instinct back then.
Right.
Happened to me with the whole HIV/AIDS thing, is that I heard about there were people who didn't believe HIV caused AIDS. But then several years went by, maybe 3 or 4 years, and I heard nothing. And I assumed, well, obviously, at some point, somebody proved these skeptics wrong. And then I realized, well, you know, the reason I didn't hear anything was because the media was closed. And that was in the 90s, so the internet didn't exist. So I really didn't have good access to some of this other information.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give some examples of historical conspiracy theories that eventually were accepted as the truth? Things that were, you know, really strongly opposed at the time, but now generally accepted as true?
Well, there is, of course, Watergate and Iran-Contra. And I would say the Iraq war propaganda counts. And I think the Holocaust is kind of a good example. Because it used to be a conspiracy theory to suggest that the Nazis were doing anything more than, you know, relocating the Jews. You know, the idea that there was this mass extermination program going on, you know, that's a little bit
like
wild,
if you had asked the Nazis during World War II if they had admitted that they were putting Jews and gypsies and socialists and whatever mentally what they would call mentally retarded in those days, people in camps, they would have said just to protect them or, you know, something, right?
Right. And I believe they had people in the camps writing letters to the relatives, basically telling them that it's okay out here. You know, so that kind of thing. So, and the fact that, well, some of it was in the open and some people knew or sort of knew or felt like they knew what was going on. You know, you could say that same thing about controversial conspiracy theories now. Some people think they know, you know, and or parts of it, you know, are documented or whatever. So I think the Holocaust is something that people should think about in this context.
That's an interesting take on the Holocaust, that it was originally would have been a conspiracy theory to believe that people were getting killed. Because powerful people in the German government would have said, you're crazy.
Right.
You know?
And even in the Allies aside, we didn't think that was happening. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk about Cass Sunstein.
Sure.
So Cass Sunstein and Adrian Vermeule, who Cass Sunstein at least was working for Obama in 2010, wrote a paper in the Journal of Political Philosophy that said that people who espouse conspiracy theories should be infiltrated and undermined by government agents and allies. So talk about that episode.
Okay, so right. So these two guys, and by the way, Sunstein, for anyone who doesn't know, you know, he got some glowing praise when he was appointed, and Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan described him as the preeminent legal thinker of our time. So he is a real big shot. And I hear other people in the academy in different fields, you know, talking about him. It's a real big name. So he writes this article, publishes it in, with his Harvard colleague, publishes it in Journal of Political Philosophy. And right, so as you say, he argues that the government ought to infiltrate groups. And then he was kind of called out on that, Glenn Greenwald in particular. And I wrote my first articles on this issue on that. And eventually there was somebody from Loose Change, Luke Rudowski, I believe his name
is. Loose Change was a video on 9/11.
I misspoke. Not Loose Change. We Are Change.
We Are Change. Okay.
Yeah. So he confronted Sunstein and asked him, you know, why do you want to infiltrate groups of survivors of 9/11 and a bunch of categories like that. Of course, Sunstein hadn't singled out those categories, but there are people in those categories, so they would be included. And Sunstein said, I hope I didn't say that, and I don't remember, you know, what I wrote or what, you know, just kind of didn't respond. And then eventually he did revise his paper, republished it as the title article in his book, Conspiracy Theories and Other Dangerous Ideas, where he now tries to say that, well, he was misinterpreted isn't it an irony, you know, how badly people have misunderstood him and just the way that he was talking about. What he suggests now is that, of course, he was only talking about foreign conspiracy theory groups, not domestic, even though most of his examples are domestic.
I actually have an example of a group being infiltrated, arguably by the U.S. government. I run the group Rethinking AIDS, and I was contacted by this man named Joseph Newton, so some years ago, it might have been 10 years ago now. And he asked me, you know, his communications were a bit weird. It was almost like there were multiple people writing to me, because at different times he took different tactics. But sometimes he was kind of fawning in his praise, trying to encourage me to say something crazy. And other times he would be kind of arrogant and say, you know, why are you wasting your time on this? You're never going to make any change, stuff like that. So he sort of had multiple personality disorder. But we eventually were able to prove that he was actually a psychology professor named Seth Kalikman from the University of Connecticut. And we knew this because he attended a conference under the name Joseph Newton, but he provided his phone number, his fax number, his office address, all were of Seth Kalikman. So we pretty much had him nailed. And he actually published a book where he had a photograph of himself at the conference, but he whited out his name tag because his name tag didn't have his name on it. That's somebody else's name.
Right.
So he was not exactly the brightest spark in the arsenal of undercover agents. But it was kind of strange that he was doing this. And I don't know if I doubt somebody in the government said to do this. I think for him it was just like, I'm a psychologist studying conspiracy theories, so I can get some money for, you know, studying Rethinking AIDS. And then he published a book on, quote, denialism. And so I think it was just in order to produce his book, he thought he'd go undercover and get all this, these secret discussions that we had, even though we're very public about our concerns about the theory. So why would you need to go undercover?
Right. Right. And there is the history of infiltration, right? I mean, we got COINTELPRO and and Sunstein doesn't mention them by name, I don't think, but he does, in a sense, refer to that. But he kind of whitewashes it when he does and isn't really quite honest about the fact that COINTELPRO was pretty ugly stuff going on, you know, and the way they tried to undermine Martin Luther King and whatnot. So, so there were lots of problems with his argument. And then there are problems with his proposal, which we've been talking about, but there were also problems with his argument, because his argument was based on how conspiracy theories spread. And he said they spread because of informational and reputational cascades. Well, we've already just been talking about the reason reputational cascades aren't going to work very well, like in the academy especially. So you can't explain people in the academy who sort of stick up for conspiracy theories by saying, oh, well, they're just following some kind of a reputational cascade. it's just not plausible.
Well, maybe he said that because that's how the mainstream works. I mean, if you go back a century in, say, medicine, and you talk about, say, the radical mastectomy, you know, for decades that was considered, you know, if a woman had breast cancer, you had to remove the whole breast. That was, and that was handed down in a hierarchical fashion, right? Nobody ever thought to actually consider the evidence, or if they did, they shut up because you're going to lose your job if you said, we don't have to remove the whole breast. So they did this for decades until finally there was enough evidence that this was disastrous, that it was no better than removing part of the breast. And of course, to the woman, the psychological and physical consequences were much greater. But I mean, that acted as if it was a conspiracy theory. You know, one person, powerful person, says this is what you must do, convinces everybody in their hospital. Those people, they get jobs in other hospitals, and it just like cascades down so that every oncologist is doing the same thing. But there was never actually a conspiracy. They didn't all get together in a room and say, we can make more money if we cut off women's breasts, you know?
Right. Just a paradigm sort of takes hold, and he's right when he talks about the cascades. I mean, that's a real phenomena. The problem is that it works both directions,
right?
And it works better in some circumstances than others, and it seems like it doesn't really work very well at all in explaining conspiracy theories in the academy, or certainly among, you know, journalists or that kind of a thing, because they're often you know, if you have a journalist that gets too involved in conspiracy theories, they get pushed out into the out of the mainstream, basically. Have to have their own website and whatnot.
I mean, from what I've seen in non-mainstream theories, like we've talked about AIDS, you also briefly mentioned 9/11, is that there are, in those groups, there are some people who just kind of like the idea of, you know, they just sort of intuitively feel that you know, they're being lied to. But there's also individual thinkers. I know AIDS better. You mentioned Peter Duisberg, but there's actually probably 100 scientists and academics who've individually made a critique, which is significantly based on their own work. So it's not like the hierarchy is working to say, okay, Duisberg says this, so then his friend David Rasnick says exactly the same thing, and then some people in Australia say the same thing, because they're not saying the same thing. And they have approached it all slightly differently. So it seems like for people who question the government theory, they actually have more diversity because they don't always approach it the same way.
Well, I think that's relatively typical, you know, of scholarship in general. I mean, that you know, people dialogue with what other people have said and disagree a little bit, and you know, sometimes. Sometimes there's major disagreements, and sometimes, you know, they're just arguing about the details. I remember, you know, when I was writing on Confucianism, and I was talking to a young colleague when I was young at the time, and he said, you know, you really ought to challenge your professor. Don't just go along with what he says. And I thought, you know, I was thinking about his own work, you know. Yes, he challenges his professor, but on the edges, you know, these little things. It doesn't challenge him at the center of the paradigm. And so that's typical. But there are degrees. I mean, some people, you know, do this thing where they're all part of the same kind of community, and they're all, you know, yeah, we're all sort of on the same page, but we're disagreeing about this and that little detail. And then you've got people who are making more significant criticisms, and then you've got people who challenge the whole paradigm or whatever. So I think you do have, I mean, I guess this goes to Kuhn's whole scientific revolution thing. I mean, most normal science is you're just working around the edges,
right, within the box.
Yeah,
you know, you know the limits, that you don't go outside. I mean, I read a fair amount for a while on the various 9/11 theories, and you know what I concluded was that there was a wide variety of different theories about 9/11, about why it happened, and about what exactly happened. Mm-hmm. You know, there were people who said that there were no planes who flew into the towers. It was all like, what do they call, CGI, computer-generated graphics or something. So people had a lot of theories, and some of it made sense to me, like the especially Building 7 on the World Trade Center. I have no other explanation for that collapsing other than a implosion demolition. That was demolition. Yeah. But other things just to me seemed crazy, right? Mm-hmm. But I felt like I was approaching it like, I don't really want to believe this, but these people, some of this is making sense to me, and some of it I just think is crazy. Like one guy who said it was a nuclear bomb that blew up the towers. And I'm going, okay, well, where's the fallout?
right. Yeah, one wonders what to think about some of them. In terms of, like, is this person even honest or serious or...
Yeah, I mean, within AIDS, also, there's a conspiracy theory that the U.S. government created a virus. And that gained quite a bit of traction, especially amongst the black community. I think I can understand why black people wouldn't necessarily trust their government when it came up and said this. So for a while, there was quite a bit of attention paid to this, and there were attempts to kind of meld these two things together. So the people who said, you know, HIV doesn't cause AIDS, or people who went further and said HIV doesn't exist, were kind of blended in with the people who said, well, HIV exists and it kills, but it's not a natural virus. It was created in Fort Detrick or somewhere like that.
Right.
Even though these are radically different and opposed theories, but it seemed to help try to dismantle a theory by saying these people are just crazy conspiratorial people believing in a government conspiracy.
Right. You lump them all together in a sort of guilt by association.
Yes. Even though if you think about the theories, you realize that, you know, they obviously can't all be true. You can't believe that HIV was created by the government and it doesn't exist.
Well, according to some people, you can believe that. If I may follow that line, because it goes to my own research. There was a paper published in 2012 called Dead and Alive. It's a psychology paper. And so they did a study where they concluded that conspiracy theories, conspiracy theorists are not deterred in their beliefs by blatant contradiction. And so the more you believe, according to them, the more you believe that Osama bin Laden was already dead at the time of the raid of his compound, the more you believe that, the more you believe he's still alive.
Okay, so
that's the dead and alive.
Right.
And the same thing with theories about the Princess Diana and whatnot.
Might believe that she was killed by some kind of a conspiracy to silence her, but at the same time, she's alive in Bolivia.
Right, she faked her own death.
Right.
Okay.
So,
problem with that, okay, and then that got picked up on by Sunstein and many other people, like in psychology in particular. They're doing these other studies, and they're referencing his study, and they're mentioning that conspiracy theorists they have this monological belief system, and that's part of the evidence for it. The problem is the study didn't have anything to do with belief. It had to do with, you know, rating on a scale of, I think it was 1 to 7, of how plausible, convincing, worth considering, or coherent various theories were.
Right.
And some of these theories were inconsistent with each other, but there's nothing irrational about thinking two mutually inconsistent theories are both relatively coherent or worth considering.
Right,
or
right.
Even convincing or plausible.
Oh, right? Okay. And I think if you asked me about 9/11, I would say, well, I'd like to hear more about, you know, the sort of the aborted investigation that the U.S. government did. I'd like to know more about the thermite demolition theory. I'd like to know more about what happened to the Pentagon. Like these things, and some of them, like for example, with the some of the flights, some people say the flights never took off. They didn't happen. It's like, well, I think that's worth investigating. Other people say that, yeah, it did, but it was, you know, part of some other type of conspiracy. I agree that they can't all be true, but that doesn't mean, if you don't know the truth, you obviously have to follow up different leads, go down different avenues, right?
Right. And it's not as though people, you know, rated these as 7. Oh, I rate the plausibility or convincingness of the theory as a 7, and then I also rate as a 7 the another theory that's inconsistent with that. They were, you know, in fact, some of like the mean was like 1 point something on some of the answers. So I mean, even a 2 on a scale of 1 to 7 was still relatively high, you know. So that was nevertheless treated as if you had caught them in believing a contradiction, and it just simply isn't supported by their own data.
I think people can believe contradictions, but I think some, you know, powerful mainstream people can believe contradictions as well.
We all believe contradictions, probably.
Right. Yeah,
but not obvious ones.
Right.
Right.
And also, I think if you take people as a group, like if you talk about Trump supporters, there are those who believe that Trump is being undermined by the deep state. And there are those that believe that Trump's about to arrest Hillary and throw all of the top Democrats in jail. Right. This is a big conspiracy. Some people think that the FBI's out to get him, and other people think he's going to turn around and use the FBI to arrest people. But that, they're not necessarily the same people. It's easy to lump all Trump supporters with their MAGA hats into one lump of people who are, you know, so ignorant they can believe these two completely different things at the same time. But it might be two different people.
Right. One of the points that I wanted to make about this whole dead and alive and some of the other problems in the social science research is that conspiracy theorists are often criticized or caricatured as people who don't reason very well, and certainly probably some of them don't. But there is some irony in these social scientists doing these kinds of studies, which involve not reasoning very well themselves about the evidence that they're looking at, about the data,
And I mean, take the weapons of mass destruction. There were a lot of very smart, very powerful people who swallowed that theory. So I don't believe they were all in on a grand conspiracy. I think they just weren't very skeptical about it and accepted it despite all the red flags.
Sure. And again, there could have been some element of conspiracy and a lot of what you're describing as well. Mm. They, those two things aren't those don't conflict. Those can go together. And probably do. Mm-hmm. And we just don't know to what degree the whole thing was conspired and to what degree it was just, you know, as you described.
One of my concerns is that conspiracy theories are one mechanism, using the word denialism as another, of stifling debate. And so that even if the people who have a crazy theory are wrong, having the discussion deepens people's understanding. I mean, I look at it as like teaching evolution. I'm not opposed, even though I'm an evolutionary biologist, I'm not opposed to to talking about creationism. In fact, I think it's important to understand our history. But I think that the children who are taught about the various creation myths, which I think are myths, but you don't have to call them that, and they're also talked about Darwin's theory and other theories of evolution, so we'll end up with a stronger understanding than children who are told, Darwin is true, here's right. the facts, and these are things that are not true. And so what are you really learning there? You're regurgitating, this is Darwin's theory, I can regurgitate a few facts about it, but I have no understanding about how he came to believe that, why we should believe it.
There's a very good book that makes your case. It's called Seeking God in Science, and the subtitle is An Atheist Defends Intelligent Design. It's a very intellectually honest book. Here's an atheist. He's not arguing that intelligent design is true. He doesn't think it is true. Otherwise, he wouldn't be an atheist anymore. But he is arguing that they do have arguments that are not as weak as some of their critics make them out to be. And so he tries to give a fair evaluation of the arguments. And one of the things he says, he's just like you suggest, that teaching this in school can help people learn how to do science. Yeah. I mean, learning to do science, right? Just like, I'm sorry, cutting you off, but just as you were saying, by having an alternative, and you can say, well, why is it, that we should favor this one of the evolutionary theory above the other one? If right. you don't have the foil to compare right. with, or then it's just sort of accepting dogma.
I remember reading, I was a big fan of Stephen Jay Gould, who sadly died too young, but he wrote a lot of books that covered topics of evolution. And he did some research into what is seen in many textbooks on evolution of the family tree of horses, and also the theory that giraffes grew long necks by always reaching a little bit higher, and in terms of stress, they'd be, the ones that had higher necks would survive, etc. And he said there's absolutely no evidence for either of those in the evolutionary record, right? We do not have the evidence to put together a detailed family tree of horses, and we really have no evidence to say that giraffes evolved from shorter necked animals. It could have been that there was a mutation and a giraffe, was the first giraffe was born with a neck 4 feet longer than his parents, and everybody thought he was a freak, but it worked. But that's a conspiracy theory, that because teachers wanted to believe it, it just went from textbook to textbook to textbook, and textbooks would copy it from other textbooks, and nobody ever went back to the beginning to say, is this true? Which is a good example of evolutionists believing a myth because they think it strengthens their scientific case, which obviously doesn't, right? Like, you can't use a myth to strengthen a scientific argument.
Right. I think that's an example more than of a conspiracy theory, but of a cascade that we were talking about.
Right, right.
Just pass it down.
I mean, it's kind of like the weapons of mass destruction. You want to believe to justify you're going to have a war with Iraq. You don't want to feel you're having a war without justification. So sure, he's got nuclear bombs. Yeah, that's good enough reason.
Right.
So I'm not going to ask too many questions about what evidence we have for it. We only have a couple minutes left. So is there anything that you'd like to cover? And maybe you can talk a little bit about your pamphlet.
Okay, yes. So what I've been doing sort of in two things recently. I mean, I've been doing the sort of critique of the social science literature. And one of the articles I've written recently on that topic is Conspiracy Theories and the Paranoid Style. Do conspiracy theories posit implausibly vast and evil conspiracy theories? And then sort of based on that, I did a popularized version of that, which I published as that booklet, which is kind of framed rather than a critique of the social scientists, it's kind of a defense of conspiracy theorizing in general. And in that sense, it's kind of a defense of particularism. I think we talked about that a little bit, but particularism, you should look at the particulars of a conspiracy theory and judge it on its own particular merits.
Yeah, I don't think we did, but that is one of the things I meant to talk about, and I think it's very important, and I certainly agree. It makes sense that you cannot meta-analyze conspiracy theories, because that implies that you have to a priori assume that they're all wrong.
Right, and because we already know that at least some have turned out to be true, that we can't really make that assumption. And so one thing we do is in order to sort of defend the idea that conspiracy theorizing is an important activity, especially in a democracy, somebody's got to be suspicious,
right?
You know, because sometimes things are going wrong. And so, and looking at the history of conspiracy theories and the history of bad behavior, which is often sort of glossed over in the mainstream media and also in the academy, really. I mean, and then also considering things like we talked about the uneven consequences for belief, but there's also something that philosopher Lev Basham has talked about is called toxic truths, which is basically that there are some ideas that are so problematic if they're true that nobody really has an interest in even pursuing it. I mean, you know, maybe 9/11 could be seen in this light. You know, what would happen if we were to one day wake up and realize, oh, actually, you know, 9/11 was an inside job. You know, what are the implications for that? For the stock market, for civility in the country, and you know, so nobody really wants to go there or has an interest. And on a smaller scale, a journalist, for example, if they stumble upon, you know, smoking gun evidence or whatever, you know, but not something that's readily believed. I don't know how to frame it, but if they come to believe that, there's consequences.
Right. If you come to believe that there's a group of pedophiles in your town and they, you know, don't have a lot of power, that's one thing. But if you believe that there's a group of pedophiles, you know, like the Jeffrey Epstein case, where there's all these powerful people, that suddenly becomes a very dangerous theory, because you now have a whole bunch of powerful enemies. You know, and yet it's really the same theory as if you said, you know, in a particular immigrant community, there's a pedophile ring. You know, nobody's except that community is going to suffer if it's true. But if you say former presidents are involved in pedophile behavior, then all of a sudden you've got some pretty powerful enemies. And you kind of figure if it's those people, then probably some other powerful people who are also involved.
Right. And those people don't have to do anything. Your direct supervisor isn't going to want to offend those people either. And they don't have to communicate to him. You know, nobody has. There doesn't have to be any kind of conspiracy for that to be frowned upon.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And that's all it takes, really. Again, you don't even have to be fired or be threatened to be fired.
Just the thought.
You just know that you might be frowned upon and you don't want to have your reputation sullied.
Right. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining me today. We had some technical problems to start with, but once we got going, it was great. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, David.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 204 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.